8. Alligators, not enemies. It's a time-honored tradition in Washington for politicians, especially Republicans, to spar with the media. The gentlemen and gentlewomen of the press have long been accused of liberal bias, and with some good reason, as I'll explain shortly. But right up there with the deep state is another phrase in the vocabulary of the Trumpian Republican Party that puzzles me as an outsider, calling journalists the enemy of the people. Of course, the press reaction to this ill-advised line was characteristically overblown. Journalists do love to be the heroes of their own narrative. You would have thought Donald Trump was actually throwing the reporters in jail left and right like a tin pot dictator in a Soviet republic. Some of us, myself included, are old enough to remember all the way back to 2013 when Barack Obama's Department of Justice, led by Attorney General Eric Holder, actually spied on reporters from the Associated Press, secretly obtaining months' worth of their phone records. This included the AP's phone line and the House of Representatives' press gallery. As of this writing, the Trump administration has not been accused of anything like that. Still, it was a dumb thing for Trump to say, as it just gives the media another reason to jump down his throat. Deliberately antagonizing the press is not the way to deal with them, as most veteran politicians know. There's an old saying, never get in a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel. These days, they're buying something digital. I don't know, bandwidth? But you get the idea. Yes, the press can be annoying, even adversarial. I dealt with that plenty. But the way to handle that is to work with them, not against them. I call it feeding the alligators. There's nothing inherently bad or evil about an alligator. They're just another one of God's creatures. They hang out in the water or on the shore or in the sun. Most of the time, they don't bother you unless you bother them. But, like all God's creatures, alligators have to eat. And if you're going to be around them when they're hungry, you better have something to throw their way. Like a lot of things I've learned over the course of my career, this was something I learned the hard way. Thinking back, it was not a good day to get in my way. A major Republican bill had just failed on the floor of the House. It was the mid-1990s when we were in charge, with Newt Gingrich holding the Speaker's gavel. But even then, we couldn't always get our shit together enough to get things across the goal line. I would understand that frustration a lot better as Speaker myself years later. And by then, I knew how to take it in stride. But at that particular moment, I was just a pissed-off member, ready to get the hell off the floor. As conference chair at the time, it was my job to keep hundreds of rank-and-file Republican members on the same page as the top House leaders. And somewhere along the line on this particular bill, we hadn't been able to keep the team together. I don't even remember what the bill was about, but I do remember what happened in the minutes after it failed. I stormed off the floor pretty mad, which, as I've said, is rare for me. Most of my angry moments are notable enough that they've ended up in this book. At that moment, all I wanted to do was leave the mess of the floor fight behind me and get somewhere where I could have a cigarette and relax. And there were a lot of places back then you could smoke in the Capitol. But I should have known it wasn't going to be that easy. Before I crossed that river, I had to make it past the alligators. The members of the Congressional Press Corps were waiting to pounce. As soon as I got out in the hallway, one of them rushed me. It was Karen Tumulty, the congressional correspondent for Time magazine, and she was known for asking tough questions. She zeroed in on me like a hawk spotting a limping jackrabbit from a mile away. Some reporters will try to joke around and act friendly at first to try and disarm you before they throw you the real question. Not her. She hit me with a curveball before I knew what was happening. That one question just set me off. I was tired. I was pissed about the bill that had just failed. I still needed a cigarette bib, so I took it out on Karen. I got in her face and chewed her out. I may have used some colorful language that probably wasn't appropriate for the halls of the U.S. Congress. And I was right in the middle of refusing to answer this woman's question in the most belligerent way possible when I happened to look down and realize that she was pregnant. Needless to say, I felt like a real asshole, acting that way to a nice Catholic girl. I apologized to her right there, and I apologized pretty much every time I saw her for the next 10 years, maybe 20. From then on, I could hardly have been nicer to a reporter than I was to her. She has two fine sons, by the way. It's funny what sticks in your head and what doesn't. I don't remember the bill that failed and put me in such a sour mood, but I do remember the exchange that followed. It's true that no matter how long you've been in Washington, you're more likely to remember the people than the politics. Legislative fights come and go, but personal relationships stick around. And there are a few more interesting types of Washington relationships than those between politicians and the reporters who cover them. Some people call it a delicate dance, with each partner making subtle movements and indications in a discreet game of give and take that balances a reporter's search for information with a politician's effort to put their own spin on the story. It all sounds very sophisticated, and it's all bullshit. There's nothing sophisticated or high-minded about dealing with the press. Like I said, it's just about feeding the alligators. Before most press conferences, when I huddled with my staff and other members who might be joining in, I'd say, time to feed the alligators. And my main goal was always to feed them without getting myself bit. When I first came to Congress, I didn't make a habit of talking to the press. I wasn't used to being around a bunch of reporters. Back in Ohio, I would talk to a few local reporters now and then, or some folks who covered the State House in Columbus. But these Washington reporters were a different breed. I did, however, make a habit of smoking, and that's how I ended up right in the middle of the alligator pack. In those days, you could still smoke in the Speaker's lobby, an ornately furnished area just off the House floor, where portraits of former speakers looked down on you. Nancy Pelosi shut that down during her speakership, and although I may have considered bringing it back when I took over, I thought that would be opening one can of worms too many. I stuck to smoking in my office, which, as I've mentioned, apparently drove Paul Ryan crazy when he moved in 2015. Tough luck, Paul. But in the 1990s, the Speaker's lobby was a great place to duck off the floor for a quick smoke break. So I spent a lot of time out there, and soon a few of us, including Tom Latham from Iowa, who became my best friend in the House, started hanging out there. But reporters with House press gallery credentials would hang out there too, hoping to stop members as they came in and out of the chamber for a quick chat. Most of the time, they were respectful and didn't try to interrupt our private conversations. But we knew they always had one ear cocked in our direction. And eventually, I spent so much time out there and saw the same press people hanging around that sooner or later, I would strike up a conversation and get to know them one by one. Sometimes I'd catch them off guard by pointing out a sloppy shirt or a crooked tie. That was fun. I made them jump up a bit. Reporters are not known to be the best dressers in Washington, except the TV folks, obviously. I struck up a good rapport with some of them and tried to help them out when I could. It seemed pretty simple to me. They had a job to do, and I had a job to do. So why shouldn't I make it easier for them to do their job? That way, they might make it easier for me to do mine. As I said, toss something for the gators to chow down so they don't come after you. I've come to have a very good relationship with the press, just being myself. Not posturing, not playing games with them. Too many members tried to do that, to plant news tidbits or play different people off against each other. Most good reporters can sniff that shit out a mile away. I was as open with them as I could be. Of course, I couldn't always tell them everything, but I told them enough. I was always honest and answered their questions, but I tried to get it done in as few words as possible. The more words you say, the more chances you have to get yourself in trouble. Remember that old saying from Senator John Tower. You never get in trouble for something you don't say. But I never misled a reporter or tried to play one off against another. I told them what I could. I straight up about how much I could say. And when I'd said what I had to say, that was it. I didn't try to string them along and make them beg for more. I just let both of us get back to our jobs. In many ways, I dealt with them just like I dealt with other members. Just by being me. Maybe there were times when some of them, members and reporters, wished I'd give them more, but at least they knew I would never bullshit them. I would give the gators a snack here and there when a reporter would call my office or stop me in the hallway to talk. But the big feeding frenzies were the press conferences. We could call a press conference for special events. They were also built into the regular schedule. As speaker, I usually held two a week, with the first one coming right after the conference meetings where the leadership team discussed the week's agenda with all the members. We'd go across the hall from our big meeting room in the Capitol basement to a much smaller room where the press was corralled and waiting for us. They'd be gathered outside the meeting room trying to hear what was going on inside, and some members inside were known to text or email live updates to reporters. But if they were patient, they knew they'd get their feeding. I would take the podium and deliver the House Republican message for the week, which would then be echoed by the majority leader, the majority whip, the conference chair, and another member or two we brought along to help highlight specific agenda items. And then came the real alligator feast, the question and answer period. This was a few minutes of controlled chaos, and it was controlled only because I made sure to control it. I saw too many press conferences in my early years in Washington that were like scenes from a movie or a TV show. There was no organization. The reporters weren't even silent, methodical alligators. They were more like a pack of jabbering hyenas. They just shouted their questions over one another. It was total pandemonium. I never liked that, and I knew that was not the way I was going to do things. As I moved up in House leadership and spoke at more and more press conferences, eventually I imposed a rule. No more shouting. We were going to raise our hands. If children in elementary school can discipline themselves to do that, so can full-grown adults. I remember standing in front of the assembled press corps at one of these early occasions. "All right," I said. "The first thing is, we're going to have some order here. If you want to ask a question, put up your hand and I'll be happy to call on you. But we're not going to have everybody screaming and yelling anymore." And believe it or not, they got the message. Putting that simple rule in place helped keep my conversations with the press running smoothly, no matter which direction they went in. There was one reporter, for instance, who would often ask questions about LGBT issues, whether or not they were related to the agenda we've been discussing. I always called on him and tried to answer his questions as best I could. This was his beat, and he had a job to do. Every now and then, some knucklehead reporter from one of the TV networks, who wasn't usually a congressional correspondent, would show up to one of these things. They stuck out like sore thumbs because they didn't know the rules and kept shouting their questions. They were usually there to play some game of gotcha. Jesse Waters from Fox News used to pull that stunt. Well, I rarely ever called on those types. You know why? Because they never raised their hands. They never stood a chance. There was a reason I decided to bring some order to the chaotic Capitol Hill press conferences that had become the norm. It wasn't just to make it easier to hear the questions. Somewhere along the way, around the time I became majority leader, I realized I had been dealing with the press more frequently than I had before. So I sat down and thought about a strategy. What sort of image did I want to present? I wasn't going to change who I was, no question about that, but I did have to think about how I wanted to come across and what I wanted to accomplish each time I went before the press. The answer that came to me was pretty simple. I was going to be the reasonable, responsible adult in the room. That, I figured, was what the American people wanted and needed to see. I wasn't going to be a fire breather, at least not most of the time. There were plenty of other members who did that reliably. Before every press conference, after I made my typical joke to my staff and colleagues about feeding the alligators, I give myself a silent second reminder. It's your job to be the reasonable, responsible adult in the room. And that's the last thought I would have before walking up to the podium. Over the years, I got to know some reporters pretty well. After all, we went to work in the same place every day, even though we have very different jobs to do. Some of them, I wish, had done their jobs a little differently, a little more fairly, but most were straight shooters. Julie Hirschfield Davis, for instance, covered D.C. for a number of outlets and always played fair. Lynn Sweet, the veteran Washington reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, on the other hand, didn't even try to hide her bias, at least from where I was sitting. It got to the point where there really wasn't any point in trying to spend any time with her. Most of the TV reporters had a bit more flair for drama than their print colleagues did. But I guess that's to be expected. On TV, it's all about personality. When you go on one of those shows as a guest, the famous Sunday talk shows in particular, it's not just a simple matter of answering questions. The personality of the host is going to set the tone for the whole experience. It didn't matter which show or network you went on. They were all defined by the manner and style of their particular host. NBC's Tim Russert, for instance, was probably the classic example of tough but fair. Maybe I'm a little biased because I admit I always liked the guy. We got along well, and he even helped me raise money to give scholarships to DC kids. But that didn't mean he was ever going to be easy on me on Meet the Press. Just the opposite. I remember going on his show just a few days after I became House Majority Leader in 2006. I'd spent nearly a decade trying to work my way back into the leadership. I'd finally made it. And here I was ready to face the national Sunday morning television audience. I was playing in a bigger league, and boy, did Russert let me know it. Each question came at me like a missile aimed right between my eyes. He'd clearly done his research and pulled up clips from me years ago that, of course, I had to respond to. He even brought up the famous handing out checks on the House floor story, which at least gave me a chance to clear that up. That was from back in 1996 when I was helping raise money for some colleagues, and I brought a few checks written out to them by a PAC down to the House floor because I knew that was where I could hand them to the members directly. That seemed easier than mailing them to all different campaign offices. It was all legitimate fundraising. There was nothing illegal about it, and it wasn't even against the House rules. But people called me on it, and I could see why it didn't look so great. So I never did it again. It probably didn't help that the checks were from Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation, but 1996 was a different time. Anyway, Russert gave me a rough reintroduction to the dicey media environment that awaits a House leader. But all in all, he was a good man who did his job well, and both the media and political world suffered a serious loss when he passed away too young. One of my favorite Sunday morning show hosts, both as an interviewer and as a person, was John Dickerson of CBS's Face the Nation. Dickerson and I talked not long after it was announced that he was going to take over that slot. I gave him one piece of advice. Keep being yourself. Don't let them push you into being somebody you're not. He was one of the straightest shooting reporters I ever dealt with, and he had absolutely the right personality for a Sunday morning talk show. And I've spent a lot of time on Sunday morning talk shows. Dickerson was genuine and incisive, and could carry on an honest conversation while still getting good answers out of his guest. I didn't want any network higher-ups to pressure him into changing his style, and I told him so. Who wants to hear all this banter on Sunday? I said. Just have a conversation, which you're already good at doing. I'm proud to say he took my advice, and clearly it worked, because he was promoted to anchoring CBS's Daily Morning Show, and from there, went to the flagship 60 Minutes program. I had a lot of fun doing 60 Minutes, but well before Dickerson's time, I was lucky enough to be interviewed by the great Leslie Stahl. I went in expecting a total nightmare and came out with a few lovely minutes of television that my family still treasures. It was mid-November 2010, and I'd just been elected speaker. Right after that, my press team told me they'd heard from 60 Minutes, who wanted to throw together a profile on me. My first reaction was a firm no. I didn't want anything to do with it. We were riding high after taking back the House majority, and I didn't want to give the media a big opportunity to beat up on me before I'd even taken the gavel. But my staff was pretty insistent. They all thought it was a good idea, and they worked me over pretty good. After a couple of days of dragging my feet, it became clear I didn't really have a way out of this. We couldn't turn down 60 Minutes. They wanted to spend 4 hours with me and my family back in Ohio, and then another 4 hours with me in D.C., all for 12 minutes of television that would be watched by more than 20 million people. Well, I asked, who's going to do the interview? The answer came back, Leslie Stahl. I went back to thinking this was a terrible idea. I knew she leaned to the left, and I was convinced she was going to turn this into a hit piece. At the same time, Leslie Stahl had a long and distinguished career in TV journalism. She'd even hosted Face the Nation in the 1980s. And I admit, there was a time when I had a little bit of a crush on her. It would hurt if she burned me on the 60-minute piece, so I had to figure out how to play this. I would meet her first in Ohio, when she showed up to interview my family the Monday before Thanksgiving 2010. We were all going to meet at St. Peter and Paul Church, and when I arrived, the CBS crew was already in place. There were lights and cameras all set up in front of the church I'd grown up going to, where my parents were married, where we had their funerals, where I'd married Deb. And if that wasn't surreal enough, there in the middle of it was Leslie Stahl. When we introduced ourselves, I told her right off the bat, "Leslie, I've had this crush on you for 30 years, and I can't tell you how excited I am about doing this." It didn't matter that I'd fought this whole idea earlier. I was in it now, and I had to play it through to the end. And besides, Leslie was awfully nice. They filmed us inside the church talking about my childhood. She got me crying. I got her crying, too, although her tears never made it onto the air. And, of course, mine did. Later, we moved the whole production over to Andy's Cafe, where my family all gathered, and where Leslie was supposed to interview me while we were sitting on bar stools. She went off to get her makeup adjusted for that part of the segment. During the break, Deb came up to me and told me, "I don't know what's going on, but this lady is smitten with you." Women can tell these things a mile away. I figured at least that meant things were going okay. The rest of the shoot in Ohio went great, and so did the 4 hours or so we spent in D.C. When it was all over, as we walked through Statuary Hall in the Capitol, I turned to Schnitt, Dave Schnittger, my top communications staffer who set the whole thing up, and told him, "There's no part of this I wouldn't mind seeing on TV." My gut was right. The segment turned out great. Not long after, a package arrived at my office from Leslie. It was a tie from an online clothing store run by her daughter, one she picked out for me as a thank you for participating. I was touched and proudly showed it to my staff, announcing then and there that I was going to wear the tie from Leslie on my first day as speaker. Joe Marie St. Martin, my legal counsel, immediately spoke up. "You can't take that as a gift. You've got to pay for it." Well, she was right, of course, so we figured out the tie's retail value, and I made sure to send Leslie Stahl a check for $87 before I was sworn in as speaker. I still like the tie, though. Dealing with the mainstream media had its challenges, but the so-called conservative media, from Fox News to Rush Limbaugh and the other radio and TV talking heads, was a whole different sort of circus whose acts ran all the way down the line from the responsible journalist to fire eaters, sometimes jumping around and taking different roles throughout their careers. Chris Wallace is and always was a straight shooter. If anything, he would grill Republicans twice as hard as he would Democrats just to avoid any appearance of favoritism because he happened to be on Fox. Megyn Kelly, when she was on that network, overcorrected in a more dramatic way. It was as though she thought she wouldn't be seen as a serious journalist unless she was tough and aggressive, even angry, which sometimes came off as not quite genuine. On the radio, Rush Limbaugh is still the king. We were buddies in the 1990s when I would feed him scoops occasionally. We even played golf together. I'd stop by and see him when I visited Palm Beach. But somewhere along the line, Rush and some of the other conservative commentators changed their model. It wasn't just about getting the message out and countering bias from other media outlets. It became a numbers game, building the biggest audience possible and making the most possible money from the advertisers who profit from that audience. Bigger audiences made for more ad money. And when they found out that ginning up anger tuned in listeners, that was it. To me, the change seemed to happen around 2010 or 2011, when Mark Levin first made a sharp turn to the right. Rush and Sean Hannity, who balances the TV and radio worlds, were afraid Levin was going to cut into their audience share, so they lurched far to the right, too. That was when Ted Cruz emerged as the alleged conscience of the conservative movement, and he was a darling to these people. They could wind him up and get him to do anything, Like, say, talk a handful of House Republicans into shutting down the government for no real purpose. But of course, the switchboards at Rush's, Sean's, and Mark's studios lit up like the 4th of July whenever something crazy like that happened. That's when these shows went from real commentary, pushing conservative ideals, to just pissing people off and making money off the anger. Clearly, it's not just right-wing media that chases ad revenue, though. It's a problem across the spectrum, and it's part of why the United States is so polarized today. Americans are getting a fire hose of information shot at them, and before they know what's going on, they figure they've got to be angry about something. The changes I've seen firsthand in the last few decades have been striking. The press used to strictly report the news with less commentary. That was the case for mainstream print, TV, and radio news. Now these outlets offer a lot more opinion pieces alongside the news because people click on opinion pieces they agree with, and clicks mean more ad money. But sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between reporting and opinion. Legitimate journalists go on cable TV as guests or contributors, but don't just stick to the facts. They speculate and offer their opinion as pundits. And that way, the media has gained more power than ever before. But when you have people on TV talking and talking for hours on end, they have to come up with things to say, which means more chances for outrage or bias to color the facts. A lot has changed since there were only a few radio talk show hosts that most people hadn't heard of. One cable TV channel that just did news. No internet, no Facebook, no YouTube, no Twitter. Today, Americans are being inundated with information from all kinds of sources, some legitimate and some not. Some of what's out there is true, and some isn't. It's certainly gotten worse since the 2016 election. I know plenty of people have said that already, but I'll say it again. There are huge chunks of the country that don't trust the media at all, or they only trust certain outlets, or are convinced that all the others except their favorites are peddlers of dangerous anti-American propaganda. It's ugly. I'll say this for the Trump vocabulary. Fake news is more than just a catchphrase. It's a real problem, but it doesn't help when people use that term just to refer to a story they don't agree with, as both Democrats and Republicans like to do since the term became popular. Unfortunately, that's going to keep happening as opinions compete with facts and people get pulled more and more into separate camps. I don't have all the answers we need to fix this situation. I thought the media environment was tough when I was speaker, but I never expected anything like what it has turned into since 2016. Americans should be smarter than this. If there's one thing no American likes, is being taken for a ride. And when someone on television or radio or elsewhere in the media is trying to gin you up to get you mad about something, that's exactly what's happening. They're trying to profit off your anger by selling ads. So maybe it's time to stop looking at every New Day's headlines as a chance to prove your political point right and the other guy wrong. If the news becomes fully weaponized, we're in big trouble. The alligators may end up eating all of us.